Hello, everyone. I'm Bill Roggio. I'm a senior fellow at Foundation for Defense of Democracies and editor of FDD's Lone War Journal. This is Generation Jihad, the podcast that covers all things in what used to be known as the global war on terror, but we now call the Long War. Today is Monday. My co-host is my friend and colleague, Joe Truesman. He's a senior research analyst at FDD's Lone War Journal. He focuses on Palestinian terror groups, Hezbollah, all of the goings on in the region with respect to both groups. Today, we are going to talk Turkey. Our also friend and colleague, Sinan Sinni, he's a non-resident senior fellow at FDD and an expert on Turkish and domestic politics and foreign policy. Sinan's been a guest before, and he's going to join us, as well as Melissa Sachs. She's a director of network analysis at Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Sinan, Melissa, welcome to Generation Jihad.
Thank you.
Hey, Bill, good to be here.
Yeah, great to have you back, and great to get you on first time, Melissa. Really looking forward to today's conversation.
Thanks so much.
No, it's pleasure is all ours. Before we get to Turkey, there is a pretty significant development. You know, today's Monday. Joe and I usually, you know, to give a roundup of what's happened in, you know, in Israel, Palestinian territories, whatever, the Red Sea, the militias. We try to hit the big developments, but there was a big development over the last 24 hours. Joe, tell us what happened and what's the significance.
Right. So the story's still developing, but from everything I've been able to gather, Israel conducted an airstrike in the Al-Mazakh neighborhood in Damascus. This was a few hours ago. Anyway, the significance of this attack, this airstrike, is that it targeted a high-ranking or high-value IRGC target. It was a high-ranking IRGC official. And he was in charge, according to reports, of course, he was in charge of IRGC operations in Syria and Lebanon. So I can't say for sure if he's the highest ranking official that's been killed by the Israelis in Syria. However, it's pretty big. He's identified as Mohammed Zahedi. And the attack is significant, not only because of the target, right, who was killed. And I think I believe there's about four or five other officers under his command that were killed in the strike. But what was attacked, right? This guy wasn't in some kind of compound in the Damascus countryside. This guy was in the he was in the Iranian consulate, right, beside the Iranian embassy, right, in Damascus. So this is significant, right? So I expect there's going to be some sort of response by the Iranians here, because I mean you can look at it like this: not only did the Israel attack you know, an IRGC official, but they attacked an Iranian government building, right? So we'll see what happens, but it's significant. And then there's so many other things I could just keep talking about what's happened over the weekend, but I just wanted to point this out. And I think later in the week with Benham on Friday, we can delve a little more into this when we know exactly what all the information, you know, what exactly happened. Because there's also some rumors that Islamic Jihad's Secretary General was there too. It's just a rumor right now, right? So, but for sure, this high-ranking IRGC official was killed in the strike. So, it's pretty significant.
Well, if he was there, that would be an excellent twofer for the Israelis. But no response from the Iranians at this point, either verbal or physical.
No, I mean, there's some reports seen that there's going to be the typical we're going to respond at our time and our choosing, blah blah blah blah. But it's just, I mean, this happened just hours ago, so it's going to take time. Nevertheless, this is really significant compared to previous Israeli strikes in Syria. So I think it was noteworthy to mention.
No, absolutely. Yeah, and we will delve further into this on Friday with Benham. We'll definitely get more facts. You know, as my friend John Batchelor always says, fog of war, first, reports can often be wrong or confusing. So we'll have a couple of days to sort this one out and go into more detail. All right, great. Thanks for the update on that. And let's get into it. Sinan, I'm going to start with you. Starting back in late 2020, as Turkey was facing hardening diplomatic isolation and economic woes, its president Erdogan began to publicly display an openness towards rapprochement with Israel. Ultimately, in August of 2022, Israel and Turkey announced a full renewal of diplomatic ties. Then October 7th happened, of course, where Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad and others attacked on Israeli territory. We all witnessed the horrific events. There was a complete 180, and I'm going to quote from the Times of Israel on this. Here we go. Over the past 5 months, the Turkish Islamist leader has called Israel a terrorist state and accused it of conducting a, quote, genocide in Gaza. In December, Erdogan called Netanyahu, quote, worse than Hitler, end quote, said the systematic slaughter of 6 million Jews in the Holocaust was not as bad as Israel's war with Hamas in Gaza, and likened Israel's treatment of Palestinians in the Strip to that of Jews rounded up in concentration and death camps, end quote. That's kind of ironic that he, first said that this was worse than Hitler and then used Israel's treatment of Palestinians, compared it to Hitler's treatment of the Jews, but neither here nor there. So given all of this, why does Turkey continue to trade with Israel and vice versa? Why does either side continue to engage, even if it's just economically? I mean, this is quite the rhetoric coming from Erdogan. I mean, this is, I just would have expected all relations to be cut off.
Yeah, I mean, just looking at it, you would think his views are a little unclear, right, on what he thinks about Israel.
Exactly. it's very nuanced take from Erdogan, right?
You know, exactly. I mean, the funny thing is, if your listeners just basically Google trade between Israel, Turkey, right, you're going to see year on year for the past 25 years where trade is just continuously, it's a continuous curve up, right? It's never diminished. And that's, you know, October 7th is the massive sort of shock that really upset that rapprochement, as you said. But, you know, Erdogan started sort of killing at Turkish-Israeli ties beginning in about 2007, 2008, right? And despite that, trade has always continued to grow. So, and that's the legitimate question. Why does this still happen? On the Erdogan front, it's really easy to answer. They just have no option, right? But they need hard currency for exports, right? The Turkish economy is, you know, has the highest second or third highest rate of inflation in the world right now. It is facing its tremendous pressure on all sides. You know, the currency has collapsed against the dollar. Its investment grade status is more than junk, right? So it doesn't have the luxury of putting its money where its mouth is, right? And cut, you know, if you're going to vilify and really sort of call out Israel for what he thinks it is, then you're right. You know, you would say that I'm not going to, you know, continue to do this, you know. And if you look at the list of exports that Turkey's continuing to sort of supply Israel since October 7th, it's not like pots and pans. It's primary materials for making, you know, that the Israeli military uses for all sorts of things, from thermal underwear to actual explosives that go into munitions making, and to actually, you know, Turkey's the largest supplier of concrete to Israel, right? So he has no luxury to that. And for Israel, it's also a relatively, you know, easy explanation. It's really hard to just, you know, shift your sourcing priorities from one, you know, bunch of countries or suppliers to another overnight. This will take time. But as I understand, that the, you know, Israeli firms are also looking for other sort of harbors in order to get that sort of, you know, their supplies.
And Sinan, again, for you, when unpacking yesterday's election results, we have to consider Erdogan's vitriol against Prime Minister Netanyahu. More broadly, Israel's defensive war in Gaza, even though it's just we discussed, Turkey has continued trade with Israel since October 7th. Could Erdogan's bombastic statements contributed to the losses yesterday, or is it more complicated than that? Is a lot of this more, you know, all politics are domestic? Is this a problem with Turkey's rising inflation and other economic problems? Or is it possible that his excessive comments, is that a possibly turn off support from a significant segment of voters?
Yeah, those are good questions. Let me just preface this by sort of touching upon something that you said just, that, you know, in your opening statement, which was, you know, what all the name calling that Erdogan's engaged in against Netanyahu, the Israeli state, whatever. It's pretty rich coming from him, because as the sort of war in Gaza has begun and continued since October 7, right, what international sort of news cycles have failed to keep an eye on, because there's so much focus on what's going on in Gaza, Lebanon, Syria, Iran, right, which is understandable. But the Turkish military under Erdogan's, you know, direction has increased its military operations against Kurds inside of northern Syria and Iraq, to the point that they've struck so many civilian targets and military infrastructure, killing dozens and not hundreds of civilians, which are, you know, attached to the Syrian Democratic Forces, a key U.S. ally, which is trying to contain and, you know, and prevent the proliferation of ISIS, right? And, you know, that has gone really sort of unnoticed for the large part. And, you know, that's, you know, and that's a real problem that we should be sort of focusing on. But, we, you know, the world is so busy. And while this is going on, we should also say that in the next few weeks or months, we could see a major land offensive into Syria or northern Iraq by the Turkish military because Erdogan's announced it, right? So we should just preface that, you know, in name calling, you know, it's pretty duplicitous on his side. Now, yesterday was a big news day for Turkey because, like you said, Erdogan lost and lost heavy, right? In local elections, which we thought, you know, was going to be pretty inconsequential, seems to basically has turned the electoral tide of Turkey's map, electoral map. And I would say Erdogan's political days are numbered, and that's not necessarily anything in the near future, but I don't necessarily know how he gets reelected going forward. A small part of that, I think, that contributed to his loss is this sort of, you know, his stance on Israel, right? His, you know, Turkey's sort of Erdogan-based voters really demanded strong action against, you know, against Israel, not least of all by cutting trade with Israel. But Erdogan seems to have doubled down on that. How has this cost Erdogan votes? Well, his political rivals, especially Islamist parties, have called this out day and night, saying you guys are so, you know, hypocritical. And it's not like it's secret. They publish data like state statistics of exports to Israel, right? Breakdown line item by line item, right? And what this seems to have possibly caused, because we haven't seen how the data, the raw, anything but the raw data is, at worst, it's caused a lot of AKP supporters to stay at home and not vote for the Erdogan, or worse, go and vote for their alternatives, right? So it's really cost him dearly. And we don't know the extent to which his stance on Israel, you know, is, but it has cost him something.
And one quick follow-up. I was quite shocked by the results of the election. Was I right or wrong to be shocked, Sinan?
Shocked, but not surprised. We could, you know, we could probably see, you know, at some stage, I mean, there was always going to be a finite time, I think, at which Erdogan could continue to run the country without any consequences from the electorate, right? It's been described as a tsunami of, you know, opposition votes against Erdogan that took place yesterday. Not only did he not fail to capture, you know, Turkey's big cities like Istanbul and Ankara, he's also lost a whole bunch more, right? And what the biggest takeaway from this, you know, which was, is it sometime in the future, whether it's the 2028 presidential elections, if he can last that long, or before, who knows? We should all look to the mayor of Istanbul as his possible and likely successor. Ekrem İmamoğlu has become a national figure at this. I mean, he's just shellacked Erdogan, right? This, you know, he just re-won Istanbul, but that victory was not against the Istanbul AKP challenger. That vote was a proxy vote against Erdogan. And people, you know, he crushed his opponent by 11 margin points, getting about 52 to 53% of the vote in Istanbul. And Erdogan is absolutely terrified of him. And what we'll see going forward is he going to do anything to sort of, you know, contain him, or can he? And so it was a shocking weekend for Erdogan. And I don't think he's going to, you know, I don't think he's a happy man this morning on Monday.
So, Melissa, I have a question for you. So I remember on October 7th, I'm sure you remember this as well, but there was this video that came out of İsmail Haniyeh and his underlings, you know, Salah al-Haruri and a bunch of other guys. They were, you know, they're all praying on October 7th, you know, it's kind of like this victory lap that they did. And, you know, it was all on video. And, you know, there was some reports that, you know, that Erdogan's chief foreign policy and security advisor was asked if Hamas leaders like İsmail Haniyeh was in Turkey on October 7th, because most people thought, you know, he was in Qatar, right? And he said, they may have been, right? Just curious your opinion. Do you think he was in Qatar, or do you think he was in Turkey? Have you seen any open source info on that?
I have not seen anything on my end, and it's honestly really hard to tell. I don't know the exact answer, but I think those two options would be my top picks. one or the other, for sure.
Right, because I was, you know, I remember just looking at that video, right? And I'm looking for, you know, with just like little clues, you know, like a flag or something, just something simple. But
the screen in the background.
Yeah. And just anything that could tell me, okay, all right, where could he be, right? But yeah, nothing. It was tough. So yeah. Anyways, I was just curious. But Sinan, I have something else for you. I have another question. In the same interview, Erdogan's chief foreign policy, and security advisor also said that any Israeli assassination attempt on Turkish soil would be, and he said, unacceptable on any terms. He and other Turkish officials had previously warned Israel that there would be, quote unquote, serious consequences for doing so. At this point, after all inflammatory rhetoric from Erdogan and given Turkey support on the perpetrators of October 7th, would Israel actually be deterred from assassinating senior members of Hamas in Turkey?
I mean, you guys told me. I mean, I think that was really funny of the Turk, because what we've also seen since then is these, like, what I would call pseudo raids, right? alleging that the Turkish law enforcement has apprehended Mossad agents in Turkey. And the main purpose behind that seems to have been like, you know, just a clickbait for Erdogan's support base. I mean, who the hell knows who these people were? Maybe just rounded up some roundup people. And I say that because none of these news items that Erdogan launched since then, you know, alleging Mossad agents arrested in Turkey, was ever corroborated by Israeli sources. It wasn't even reported in the Israeli press, let alone a government response. So, you know, when we thought about sort of writing about this, you know, our colleagues at FTD said, well, is anybody corroborating? I was like, no. And, well, let's not just give him free advertising by, you know, writing about this sort of stuff without any confirmation. But, you know, a better answer to your question, Joe, I would say is, since, you know, that declaration came out by Erdogan, I don't necessarily know if he's in a position to control what Israel does inside of Turkey's borders, given just how, you know, entrenched Hamas operatives are inside of Turkey. You know, Melissa and I have been spending the past several months, you know, just puzzled and like, you know, you're like a toy and a child in a candy store, right? Yeah, which one do you pick first? And like, which one do you write up on? I'm like, oh my gosh. And if I'm not mistaken or not, wasn't Al-Ruri allegedly in Istanbul or Turkey on the day of October 7 attack? And then he was politely asked to leave, politely in quotation marks, like, you know, if I wasn't mistaken. So it's quite damning, actually, just how bad this engagement is with Hamas.
Right. I think, you know, I'll say it like this. Israel has demonstrated in the past with previous, enemies, that if it wants to get them, all right, if it wants to reach them, regardless where they are, they'll probably get them. Okay. So I don't think.
And when, regardless of when.
Yeah. More a question of when. So I don't think Turkey is going to stop Israel from doing it. If Israel really wants it, they're going to go for it. At least is my opinion. So, but good points you made, nevertheless.
Yeah. And given what we're witnessing today, right? Israel hitting an Iranian consulate, right? Is that possible? You know, is that a sign for further action? I mean, I guess we'll wait and see. I'm of the mind that the Israelis will do what they need to do if the target's right. Would they go after a lower level Hamas guy in Turkey? That's probably, that juice probably isn't worth the squeeze. But if you can get a, you know, one of the top five or a significant player behind the scenes, I think that Israel would certainly take and manage that risk. What are your thoughts on that, Melissa?
I mean, look at Sal al-Arouri. That was in Lebanon recently. I mean, right. That's like the prime example I would think of if they got him. So I totally agree with what you guys are saying. I think if the time is right, if the target is there, open Israel, I don't think Israel would hold back at all. Honestly.
Yeah, they have to. They can't pass on some of these individuals. Again, they're not going to go after your low-level fighter, maybe your mid-level commander, unless he's a, you know, one they could implicate directly in, you know, October 7th and, you know, one of the masterminds. But, you know, if they can get, again, if they can get a top five, I don't think they have the means and the opportunity to get him. I think they'll take that shot no matter where he is. It's just something they have to do. They have to show that they're serious. Sinan, let's take a step back here. Why does the Erdogan government support Hamas?
That's the million-dollar question, right? Short answer and the easiest answer, my go-to would be he can't help himself, right? There are two. I've said there are two components to his sort of to why he does this. One is absolute ideological conviction, right? I mean, Erdogan not only sympathizes with the Hamas cause, but he's also, you know, knee deep in his sympathy and advocacy for the Muslim Brotherhood movement. I mean, you name it, right? Since the Arab uprisings, he's made that very, very clear. You know, I've spent a lot of time looking at Erdogan over my, you know, career, you know, even before he became elected prime minister and president. You know, you can go and spend hours on YouTube and listening to Erdogan's, like, you know, anti-Semitic, you know, anti-Israeli stuff till you, you know, tears come from your eyes, just, you know, watching a screen. It's just nonstop. And none of that is, since he became a respectable, quote unquote, leader of Turkey, right? None of that's like dampened or whatever. He just had to sort of bide his time and just sort of sit around and wait and until the opportunity where he could essentially really hit on that. And the second reason I think he's doing it is because this sort of acrimonious Israeli vilification, right, has really worked to sort of bolster his voter potential when he needs to distract voters at home from a really pretty terrible state of economy. You need to give voters a reason to vote for you, right? And it's usually bread and butter issues like, you know, look at the strong economy we built, look at all this upward social mobility, schools are better, blah, blah, blah, right? When that fails in countries like this, right, a go-to typically is like, you know, preying upon people's sympathies and fears, right? So the fears that he's playing on is, you know, he did this at the presidential elections last year, right? When saying, if you don't elect me, then, you know, really nasty Kurds from across our border, they're going to come and sort of decimate Turkey. So you better vote for me. And people are, oh, gosh, okay, absolutely. And the other thing that he's really ratcheted up at public events and rallies and whatever is this anti-Israel stuff, right? After October 7th, he held so many pro-Hamas rallies in Turkey, right? Including New Year's Eve. I mean, it was just ridiculous. He had this massive rally in Istanbul that his surrogates and whatnot put together on New Year's Eve. I was like, for crying out loud, who's going to listen to this? And you look at the cameras, like, well, there's a ton of people. Even last night when he went on the balcony to concede, which was relatively ungracious of him, right, the way he did it. The first thing he talked about, instead of talking about anything related to the elections, saying thanks for coming out or whatever, his first 5 minutes of his, you know, concession speech, if you can call it that, is against, you know, the Israeli-Gaza war and, you know, crapping on Israel. I mean, it's like, you know, it's two-pronged for him, so it doesn't stop.
So, Melissa, this is something, you know, we, you and I, we've worked together on this for a while, I think a couple of years almost now, maybe at least a year. Anyway, about Hamas specifically in Turkey and its network there. You know, we talk about its military network, or, and it's, of course, another core component is its financial network. But, you know, what can you tell me about it, either military or financial? How active is that network in Turkey? Where is it operating exactly? And how does it operate?
Sure. So the Hamas in Turkey network is, I would say it's a pretty big network. Financially, we've seen over the years some big cases, especially with like real estate investment companies. TrendGYO was a big case. I know that we looked at that for a while. Also, I've seen in my research a lot of construction companies in Turkey. That's a pretty interesting aspect. I would say the most active thing that I see on my daily radar are, and especially now there's a lot of new ones popping up, are like NGOs that are either humanitarian aid NGOs or institutions set up by some of these members that were from the 2011 Gilad Shalit deal that were swapped and moved into Turkey. So a lot of these guys who are former prisoners in the Shalit deal were released, went to Turkey, gained citizenship, and are now setting up these NGOs that are basically, I'll give you one study in particular, is Kutad. So a man, Jihad Yarmour, who basically I would say is like the key Hamas in Turkey representative. And a lot of the financial aspects of Hamas in Turkey are, you know, under his eye as well. So Jihad Yarmour sets up this group, Kutad. Kutad invites Hamas delegations to Turkey. They set up events throughout Turkey to, you know, basically educate people on Al-Quds, Jerusalem. So you see, and they use, what we're trying to see is if they use these NGOs that are being set up, I would say pretty rapidly, there's a lot of them now. Every day there's like a new name, new group. You know, we're looking to see, are these NGOs a way of potentially laundering money? We know they're actively inviting Hamas members that are giving speeches at these organizations. But that's just a new way that we're seeing. I would say the NGO pop-ups are pretty interesting. In addition to the, you know, real estate investment companies, construction companies, they're deeply embedded in society. And these are, it's not small amounts of money, especially with Trend. I mean, these are millions and millions of dollars. So it's vast, it's large, it's super, super active. I would say, I would argue that it's even more active now than it was before. And it's important, you know, to keep tabs on it.
Right. I think I remember looking into some of those names, and this was a while back, of course, and it was obvious something was up, and we were doing this together, of course, Melissa, and but then started seeing, it wasn't just a few names, right? There's a lot of names. There's all these like individuals. It's a lot, and you're just realizing, holy moly! I mean, we don't know for sure, of course, but at least the open source information was pointing to the fact that this is a vast network. This isn't just a couple guys or something. These are different entities, as you mentioned, NGOs or big companies like TrendGYO. And I think there's still a lot more. And then October 7th happened, right? Then all these sanctions start coming down from the, right, by Treasury, which is funny. I mean, in the sense that it took such a, you know, a tragedy, a massacre for sanctions to be slapped on these guys that were essentially, there were either laundering money for Hamas in Turkey or doing some type of illicit financial transactions in Turkey for Hamas. So nevertheless, it's absolutely vast, no doubt about it. And I think there's a lot more out there, really.
And it's very open, not to cut you off too, but just it's a very open, I mean, like Jihad Yarmour, for example, every on open source, you just go into Facebook, type in Jihad Yarmour, everything's there.
You'd be surprised.
Meeting, the pictures meeting with Hamas. I mean, this is not like a, you know, under the table type of like have to go dig for it in the dark web. Like everything's out in the public, which is that's the whole crazy part about this whole thing is that, I mean, it's amazing that sanctions are happening now, but this has been going on for minimum 2011, I would say, when the Shalit deal happened, but even probably before that. And it's great that it's happening now. Do I think it could have probably happened earlier? 100%. But it's awesome that it's happening now and that, you know, Jihad Yarmour, for example, who just got sanctioned a few months ago after 10-7, who's the head of a lot of this, he pled guilty to killing an Israeli soldier in 1994. He's not some guy that's just, you know, could be Hamas in Turkey. We're not sure. No, he's like openly admitted to working with the intelligence services in Turkey. He's very outspoken and proud, and it's all open source. So it's great that we're seeing movement by Treasury and others that to get these guys sanctioned. But it, unfortunately, not to be a Debbie Downer, it's like the tip of the iceberg. There's so many individuals and entities that are in this huge network.
Let's keep this under the wrap. I mean, it's everywhere on government official social media accounts. And just, I'll make one point before when I interrupted Bill there, just on the money issue. I mean, one of the things that caught my attention, and then subsequently we've been working on this, obviously, is there was an article that came out, just a very brief article from The Economist, I think just late last year, right? It was a couple of pages in The Economist, right? Basically detailing that the amount of money that traffics through the Turkish financial system that makes it into the coffers of Hamas in Gaza is somewhere close to $1 billion a year. $1 billion a year. That's, and what they do is basically, you know, put together an unclassified, very sort of easy to understand how that money moves through Turkey into Hamas's bank accounts, as Melissa said, by sort of sympathetic international investors towards Hamas that want to fund it, but they need a way to get that money across without being flagged or seized by authorities, right? And they basically pump it into construction projects in Turkey, a part of which then gets funneled into quote-unquote charities that then sort of use instruments like crypto, which is very hard to trace, into Hamas's bank account. But if we could just contextualize just Turkey and the financial sort of relationship with Hamas, I would say it's probably the biggest, right, or at least a significant sort of contributor of Hamas's main operating monies coming into its bank. So it's really high profile.
One quick point on the designations. I know that can be frustrating. You know, you think that the Treasury all of a sudden comes out with a designation after an event. And the way it really works is these things are in the works, and sometimes, you know, there are legal cases that are being made for allies in order to get them on board with the designations. And what often happens is the designations get pushed forward quickly when a big event like October 7th happens or whatnot. So it could seem kind of odd to people that don't understand the process. And I'll be honest with you, I've talked to many people that either work at Treasury or currently work at Treasury, and I still don't understand the process fully. But the designations, I view them as useful and for us understanding the network, identifying, and hopefully getting people to stop working with them. But Melissa, you had mentioned, I believe you said his name was Jihad Yarmour. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So would he be a worthy target for the Israelis, or do you think he's too far down the pecking order? Just the way it's described, boy, the people like him seem to have an outsized influence within Turkey and directing a lot of these activities.
Yeah, and he's been pictured with Mashal Haniyeh like in Turkey multiple times. Every time you see a delegation to Turkey, Jihad Yarmour is like in the background somewhere. And I don't know. I mean, I would say he could be. I do think he's probably like lower on the totem pole, I would say, but I don't, you just never know. I don't know.
Yeah, I tend to, you know, my biases, right, tend to focus on, you know, top level leadership and military, but we forget how important the financial, the facilitators, the organizers, the religious leaders are to these organizations. When I look at the profile of someone like him, you know, it always makes me question what I think is most important in going after these individuals.
I'll say, Bill.
No,
I'll say this though. Israelis do go after financial guys, but going back historically, they'll go after them, you know, closer to home, like in Gaza, right, for example. I don't recall like targeted attempts against, you know, financial guys abroad. I mean, there's weapons, guys that procure weapons that they've taken out, things like that by finance, financial stuff. I can't remember. So, but I mean, you never know. It's possible. We got to remember Israel is in a war now, right? So this is going to last a long time. They're going to go after every person that they can, okay, that's involved one way or the other. So it's definitely possible, but I don't think it would happen anytime soon if they did. So
yeah, my guess is with, oh, go ahead, Melissa. Oh,
sorry. I was just going to say, I know Department of State recently, for some of the trend GYO guys, I know Amar al-Shawa, another huge name, Hamas in Turkey. So Amar al-Shawa, they offered a $10 million, Department of State, they offered $10 million to like know of his whereabouts recently. So I know it's not Israel going after him, but it's still, you know, he's very on the radar. There's rewards, incentives for people for any information. So that's just another avenue there.
Yeah, and put that reward in perspective. That's like the reward for the leader of Al-Qaeda's branch in Somalia or...
Yeah.
You know, that's what we're talking about here. So that tells you his import. You know, I suspect with guys like this, Israel would probably pass on hitting them in Turkey. But if they made a mistake, like decided to travel to Syria or Lebanon, and there was an opportunity, they probably, that's where they get whacked. Yeah, I think if, you know, when thinking this through and having this conversation, probably it would have to be a real top level juicy target for the Israelis.
I just bounce on that a little bit. I'm speculating here. I agree with this. You know, Yarmour is important. And to agree with you on that point, I think, like, let's say, like you said, a too good to opportunity, you know, Ismail Haniyeh is hobnobbing with whatever in downtown, some part of Istanbul, right? Yeah, I could see whereby a legitimate strike or something could happen because he's too high profile to miss. But someone like Yarmour, right? Here's the other thing. You might not necessarily need a strike or a takeout against this guy. But imagine, and this ties into this sort of what happens when Erdogan's gone. Imagine you have a relatively sane Turkish government come back into the fold and really undoes the apparatus that Erdogan's built up over the last two decades, right? It reminds me of the days when Turkish-Israeli ties were very strong, particularly the level of intelligence sharing and military-to-military cooperation. I could see a world in post-Erdogan space, which will take time to construct, whereby the Israeli could ask for an extradition, right? Now, that guy would either have to flee, right? He would have to flee Turkey, someone like Cihad Yarmour or some of these other sort of finance guys. Or if they're apprehended, I could see a world in which Turkey begins to really substantively cooperate with Israel. Because in a post-Erdogan world, we should realize at some significant level that Turkish and Israeli security views of the region and the world are broadly similar, right? They have been for a very long time, which is why we continuously ask, how and why did Erdogan ruin this relationship, given that they have so much in common? They hate Iran, right? You know, they hate, you know, they fear quite a lot of Iranian expansions in the world. So in a post-Erdogan world space, let's see what that looks like.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, Sinan, like, you know, at the very beginning, you know, we're asking, why is Israel still doing business with Turkey? And I suspect all the reasons you had mentioned are valid, right? They're stuck, you know, it's hard to just change overnight where you get your sourcing. But maybe they are banking as well on a change in government, you know, a change in outlook from a new Turkish government that would be more friendly. And you want to keep those lines open. So, you know, it's just certainly another possibility there. Sinan, other, you know, look, we all know Erdogan. He's, you know, the main guy that we look to when looking at the, you know, the anti-Israel statements. What other Turkish government elites are working to support, champion Hamas's activities, both privately and publicly?
Ooh, now I'm rubbing my hands because Melissa and I can do a double take on this, right?
Yes, let's go. Name names.
In our kitchen, we call it the kitchen, I think. What we've cooked is this new article, which hopefully will come out this week. It's now presently just getting some review with our colleagues, right? I'll say a couple of the names and Melissa can sort of, based on what we've discovered about them, she wants, sort of just give us, you know, who they're connected to in the wider Hamas world. So, for example, what we've done is like, yes, Erdogan's the big cheese. He's, you know, he's just, but it's not just him. There are senior Turkish government officials involved in this, right? And like I said, they don't make a secret of what they're doing. It's all out in the open on their Twitter accounts, on their Instagram, on the these NGOs that they patronize, right, et cetera, et cetera. So a main guy, and your listeners can basically look this up, so because we're interested in naming and shaming, and the article certainly does hope to do that. A Turkish parliamentarian that is a member of Erdogan's Justice and Development Party, his name is Hasan Turan, right? And he is the self-styled president of something called the Turkey-Palestine Inter-Parliamentary Friendship Group or something such that. Right? That's basically just the euphemism for like, you know, I am one of the biggest cheeses in Turkey that organizes pro-Hamas orgies. And what you see from that is this guy is basically, along with people like Yağmur, have really like fielded a whole number of individuals, right? And brought them into Hamas and whatnot. Another name is former Turkey's finance minister, Nurettin Nebati. This guy is just out of office. Like he was chucked out of office like 6 months ago because he was incompetent. But again, he is linked to this organization called LPQ4, right? And there are some others. But, you know, Melissa, do you want to sort of chat about who these people are connected to in terms of organizations that we sort of, if you remember any of them?
Yeah, sure. So Hasan Turan, who you just mentioned, also the group I mentioned previously, Kutad. Hasan Turan has, you know, links to Kutad as well. Some of these other NGOs, he's very, very, very intertwined with a lot of these NGOs that I mentioned that are being set up. It's like he's always a board member. And this is a member of Turkish parliament, right? So this is a high level individual. Again, the open source on this it's wild. It's just, there's no other word. It's all out there. Often he's posing in his office with Yağmur and other members of Hamas as well. So there's him, there's a few others. And it's really interesting. LP4Q that we just mentioned, another aspect that I always thought was really interesting about this was that they do a lot of work with like Malaysia and Indonesia and some of these other countries as well, and members of parliament in Malaysia and Indonesia. So you have like Turkish parliament members within these NGOs that are actively working with pro-Hamas sympathizers in Malaysia, in Indonesia. It's a whole network, and it's vast, and it's a pretty interesting spin, because when you think of it, you think, oh, it'll just stay in Turkey. It's internal to Turkey and Hamas. But no, there's like a huge international nexus to it as well. So that's something else we're looking at.
I know you kind of mentioned this earlier, Melissa, but so these, at least logistically, how do these Hamas guys get to Turkey, right? I know you're talking about Gilad Shalit, and you know some of them were deported, right? They were deported in the Gilad Shalit swap. So, but other guys as well. I mean, there's more, obviously. How do they get to Turkey, at least logistically? Do you know? Or
I mean, I'm not sure logistically. It's a great question. Like, I'm not sure logistically, but I do know that it seems as if Turkey has just been like very, I would say, a welcoming arm to whoever wants to come. You know, welcoming home. I don't think there's pushback for Hamas sympathizers in Turkey. So if you're a Hamas sympathizer or an activist and you want to find a place, that's a great place to be a Hamas sympathizer. Turkey is your place right now.
And if you have the money, you'll get citizenship too.
Yeah, right? And you can pay for citizenship. So it's like a win-win.
Right.
But yeah, I would say some of the bigger names that we've like looked at have come through the Shalit deal and have been guilty of killing people and are proud Hamas members. But the others, I would say, you know, it's hard to tell. I guess it's case by case basis, but I would just say that, you know, Turkey is a haven. So it would make sense that people would go there.
Sinan, you know, one quick follow-up question on the citizenship. Can that be revoked at any point in the future?
With the proviso that I'm not a, you know, legal expert on these sorts of things in the Turkish context, my inclination is to say yes. I mean, you know, governments can, I mean, even a U.S. citizenship can be revoked if you breach certain conditions of your citizenship. If you're a naturalized U.S. citizen, it's hard, and it requires, you know, in the U.S. context, it has to go through the court, a federal court, right? But even in the Turkish context, yes, you can be stripped of Turkish citizenship. So going forward, if that's what you're asking, if we have absolutely. I mean, that would probably have to be reviewed by any future Turkish government, right? Who is Turkey granting citizenship to? And at the outset of this, you know, of the October 7th conflict, you know, we identified, again, all out in the open, the scores of not just ordinary Hamas officials, but senior leaders of Hamas who were granted a Turkish citizenship and passports. And if you say, well, what's the so what of that? The only big so what of requiring a Turkish passport for these guys is the fact that it allows them unhindered travel. Right. I think, you know, that's the big so what about this? I mean, they can literally get on a plane, go to Iran, go to Lebanon, right? Even to Europe, you know, whatever, right?
Now
having a Turkish passport basically makes them untouchable at that level, right? So that's what's the so what of this is.
And the other aspect of that, too, is if there is a point for deporting extradition, it makes it hard. Well, it's a Turkish citizen. We can't deport our own, right? But if that citizenship is stripped, it might be easier for Israel to get, just looking ahead here. But that's what went through my mind. Sinan, Melissa, this is fascinating. Any parting thoughts before we wrap it up?
I was just going to say, they've already started limiting the involvement of Muslim Brotherhood in Turkey, right? Because Erdogan, you know, forget how his sort of rapprochement with Israel has died a death. One of the things that Erdogan has done in the last few months that's kind of like got swept under because of everything going on in the world and the region is he's mended ties with Egypt, if you can believe this. And just, I find that shocking because he called him my brother and, you know, shook hands with him in Cairo recently and hugged him and whatever. It's because when Sisi overthrew Mohamed Morsi back in whenever it was, I can't remember, early 2010s, when, I mean, you know, Erdogan cut ties with Egypt. He called him a dictator, a tyrant, a murderer, because his pal Mohamed Morsi was removed by a coup in Israel. And Turkey said, you know, I'm not going to normalize this regime, blah, blah, blah, blah, blah. And here's the so what of all of this. He's basically, you know, let bygones be bygones. He's flipped on a dime. And one of the conditions under which Egyptian-Turkish ties can be normalized is basically Egypt has demands, which is, you know, firm action on, you know, Muslim Brotherhood entities. Like, they had a broadcasting channel that emanated out of Turkey, right? Erdogan shut that down. Now, what we're seeing is more pronounced moves, you know, to say to the MB, you know, Brotherhood folks to get the hell out of Turkey, right? And I'm not sure if they're being deported or whether they're being politely asked to leave at this point. But if Erdogan can do that, the next Turkish government that's not Islamist in Turkey, I would say, you know, to, you know, one of the key sort of aspirations will be, in my reckoning, to rekindle substantive ties with Israel.
Fascinating. Any parting thoughts, Melissa?
I would just say that, you know, a lot of people, when they think Hamas, they don't think of Hamas in Turkey. They think of Hamas in Gaza. And it's important to realize that it's not just Hamas in Gaza. I mean, Hamas in Turkey is a huge, huge, huge asset and vast network to Hamas Gaza. And I would say that, you know, there's a lot of work to be done because it's very active, this network, and it's flourishing daily. And it's just a fascinating, fascinating network to look.
Sinan, Melissa, thanks so much for joining us for today's episode of Generation Jihad.
Thanks for having us.
Oh, no, always a pleasure. We'll get you guys back on soon to give us an update. Thanks, everyone, for listening to today's episode of Generation Jihad. Just a reminder, you can listen to us on YouTube, Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you listen to podcasts. Please subscribe to Generation Jihad and leave us a review, preferably a positive one, but only if we earned it. Thanks again, and we'll see you all again real soon.